Zionists, as David was just saying that. I mean, that's an impossible circle to square, isn't it?
Well, a lot of people square impossible circles. Apparently 40 or 50% of British people think that the British Empire was a benign operation. But look, it may have been possible in the early stages of Zionism for the hardcore ethnic cleansers, Labour Zionists and also the predecessors of Ben-Gurion and Smithridge, to have a few people to decorate their movement who believed you could dispossess the Palestinians and colonise them with sweet words. But that's in the past. Today, Zionism has evolved into a genocidal movement, and there is no other element of Zionism that's significant beyond that genocidal dominant component. So to try to say that you stand for any semblance of human rights, but at the same time you will involve in your movement people who support the smashing of Palestinian surgeons' hands in order to prevent them from doing operations, the genocide that we see unfold, that's quite impossible. I mean, we've had examples in the past of people who've tried to say, well, I'm not anti-Zionist, I'm just a non-Zionist. But what would you do, you know, during the struggle against apartheid in South Africa for somebody to say, well, it's not that I'm against white supremacy, I just don't have a position on it. It's absurd, bizarre, and a moment's reflection tells you that it's just not going to fly.
Mm, no, indeed. And David, what do you make of Nahmad? I mean, forcefully criticising and condemning the Palestinian resistance.
Well, it's a red flag, isn't it? I mean, as soon as you hear something like that, you know that the agenda is to oppose resistance. Of course, it's the right of the Palestinian people, specifically the Palestinian people, as well as other people under occupation, to take up arms against the occupation. It's enshrined in UN General Assembly motions and in international law. So, you know, the idea that we should be saying that there shouldn't be a right to resistance is antithetical to international human law, and it shows that this is an organisation which is there to pursue Zionist interests. It's the Zionists who don't want there to be resistance, and preeminently it's them who don't want that. So any time an organisation comes up and says, well, the resistance are bad because they do this and that and the other, no, we shouldn't be having that anymore, especially not after we've seen a year and a half of genocide. We see every single day the awful things which the Zionists are doing there. It's no longer any good to talk about this and to be lily-livered about it, if you like. These are Zionist talking points, and we should be identifying them as such.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I mean, and you mentioned the UN General Assembly. I mean, they are absolutely explicit, aren't they, about the right to armed resistance? I mean, it's very clear in them.
People under occupation have the right to resist, including armed struggle. They say the words armed struggle in the resolution. So, yeah, it's perfectly clear, yes.
No, indeed. Well, Mick, I mean, as the founder of the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign, I mean, what do you think's happening with your counterparts in the London PSC office who seem to be pushing the mod so hard?
I mean, we grew up in splendid isolation up here over the last 25 years in this little parish in the north. And the ad hoc group that initially responded to the First Intifada by becoming active in educating people, what were we going to call ourselves? We didn't even know there was a PSC in London. It was at a very low ebb. And I had been active in the VSC, the Vietnam Solidarity Campaign. So we took away the V and put in a P, and we followed that model of support for liberation of a colonial people, support for that resistance against the militarism of the Americans, and the idea of building a solidarity movement that would bring together the anti-colonial resistance with people around the world who would see themselves not as kind of, looking at it from outside, but would see themselves as an extension. Now, I mean, so we're very different organisations. I have seen people in the past, a few people over the years, who've said you can't have a meeting without a Jewish speaker. Some really weird people who, it turns out, are very timid indeed and afraid to stand their ground, who say, get me a Jewish speaker. And it's pretty pathetic sometimes and quite insulting to your Jewish comrades who are hardcore anti-Zionists. Yes. So I suspect it's timidity, looking for somebody to push to the front to say, look, we don't really go too far from British foreign policy.
Yeah, indeed. Well, David, what do you know about this, what's his name, Eli Ovitz, the CEO of this Limud festival, for which Trevor Chin's also a key funder, isn't he?
Well, I mean, all the way through the Zionist movement in this country and in every other country where the Zionist movement is organised, there are people who have been on active service in the so-called IDF. And all the way through the Zionist movement, there are those who are using their charitable organisations and their companies to raise money to send to the so-called IDF, to the settlements. So this is a guy who, you know, yeah, of course, he's a reservist, can be recalled at any time. And let's remember, something like, we think, 3,000 British citizens have fought with the IDF in Gaza or in the rest of occupied Palestine in the last year and a half. So this is absolutely par for the course. Limud, of course, let me just be clear, is a Zionist organisation. It poses as a nice, friendly, cultural organisation, just like JW3, which is where it's based quite often, which is the Jewish Community Centre in northwest London, which of course also is famously Zionist, and is including, of course, funding by people from people like Trevor Chin. Trevor Chin, of course, as we've said many times in this programme, is effectively the leader of the British Zionist movement. He's been at the head of the United Jewish Israel Appeal, which is the main charity body raising funds for Zionism in this country for decades, I mean, literally decades. And of course, he's a massive funder of the Labour Party, including, of course, secretly funding Keir Starmer. Just information about that, of course, just released after it was too late to stop voting for him. And of course, he then joined the Labour Party as a staff member in Keir Starmer's first meeting with the rest of the Israel lobby. So this is a guy who's extremely serious and pulls a lot of the strings within the British Zionist movement, and is at the leadership of that organisation, and has many other charitable roles, i.e. in supporting the genocide.
Sure. Well, Mick, I mean, why do you think Nomad mobilised against David Miller? I mean, I guess the answer's probably obvious, but what's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, what's not to mobilise against? David won a stunning victory which does protect everybody in their jobs to some degree in distinguishing between the crimes of Zionism and distinguishing between Zionism and Jewishness and Judaism. So that's unforgivable, because the essence of Zionism, an axiom of Zionism, even before they chose to fall upon the people of Palestine, even when they were discussing Uganda, Patagonia, etc., Madagascar, the axiom was that Jews could not live among others as a minority, had to leave Europe and fall upon some people and colonize them. So to distinguish, to repudiate Zionism completely is unacceptable to Nomad. It's unacceptable to people who are trying against every day's news headline to straddle the divide between support for Israel in some way and the grotesque crimes of that state. Today, 115 medical workers were assassinated, shot in the back of the head, and it seems with their hands tied behind their back. Yeah. This is Israel, and this is the picture that the world has now absorbed to a huge extent. If you're trying to maintain any kind of link to that genocidal entity, then you're going to fight somebody who says not that there was a fall from grace in 1967, but it was a genocide. It had an inbuilt tendency to genocide and a settler colonial project from its very inception.
Sure.
You can't bridge that gulf. So, of course, they're going to go for every anti-Zionist without exception. And David's victory was extremely prominent and valuable to all of us.
Indeed it was. Well, our next report looks at the role played by a key Zionist think tank in delegitimising support for Palestine and criticism of Israel.
Nomad was quick to condemn the October 7th Al-Aqsa flood as terrorism and a war crime. It also has called for the unconditional release of what it calls all Israeli hostages. When considering the focus of the organization on trying to draw in supporters of Palestinians and Palestinians specifically to its vicinity, it terms to represent a form of strategic engagement, which a key Zionist think tank suggested to deal with delegitimization over a decade ago. The Root Institute was founded in 2004, and its first client was Israel's National Security Council. The think tank asserts that it was established to serve Israeli government agencies and decision makers. from top-ranking politicians to government professionals who hold positions of authority, leadership, or influence. It proudly carries out these services for Israeli government agencies free of charge, though it is handsomely funded by a network of Zionist billionaires. The Root Institute released an introductory video listing the following Israeli government agencies as clients: the Bureau of the Prime Minister, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, the Ministry of Finance, the Ministry of Defense, the Ministry of Industry, Trade and Labor, the IDF, the National Economic Council, and the aforementioned National Security Council. Over a decade ago, the Root Institute published a paper defining London as a hub for delegitimization of Israel. The group put forth a two-pronged strategy for dealing with what it termed, on one hand, delegitimizers, and on the other hand, criticizers. Delegitimizers were to be shut down at every opportunity, with venues that host them harassed until cancellation. On the other hand, critics were to be allowed to exist but be targeted by what Root terms strategic engagement strategies to drag them in the direction of accepting Zionism, even if only partially. The question must be asked, is Na'amad a form of strategic engagement to facilitate normalization by stealth based on the Root Institute model?
David, what do you make of this Root Institute that you just referred to in the film there?
Well, I mean, as the film was suggesting, they've been doing all this work for the Zionist regime. And they did this famous report, as the film mentions, the London is a hub of delegitimization report, which has been extremely influential throughout the Zionist movement, not just in relation to an organization like Na'amad, but the whole Zionist movement. So, and that strategy they've adopted to distinguish between the criticizers, which you might say would include someone like Na'amad, and sometimes people who are a bit more radical than Na'amad as well. I mean, PSC would be included in that, and other Stop the War probably is part of that, who are not fundamentally opposed to the existence of the State of Israel, which of course any proper anti-Zionist is. So they want to make a distinction between those who are delegitimizers, who believe that that there's no legitimacy to the Jewish state, to the State of Israel, and it must be dismantled, and those who are just a bit concerned about apartheid or the occupation or human rights or even genocide. I mean, they're concerned about genocide, but they don't want to actually deal with having to solve the problem of genocide. And the only way to solve the problem of genocide, as everybody can see, is to abolish Zionism and to dismantle the Zionist state. So it's a strategy which has been adopted across the whole of the Zionist movement, and you can really place almost every Zionist organization on some kind of continuum, how close they are to being just criticizers, and how close they are to being in the home domain of Zionism.
Yeah, indeed. Well, Nick, I mean, it seems the Root Institute labelled London, then, as we heard in the film there, as the hub of delegitimization. I mean, how does that make you feel in Scotland?
I feel great. We dined out for a very long time on the Israeli diplomats who told Haaretz that every visit to Scotland was like a visit, quote, to enemy territory. That's the position we wish to try to defend going forward. But, you know, when Palestine Action come into the field and we slip down the league from near the top, we're delighted. And I think in many ways, London is the hub of delegitimization. You have a million people marching through London. We haven't achieved that kind of ratio up here. That would be about 100,000. We've not come near it. So, yeah, London has achieved a lot. But, you know, I think what your introduction and what David has said is absolutely true. You've kind of removed the need to add much to it. But Reut and other, especially Reut, but other institutions have concluded that Israel is indefensible, that you don't want to talk about what Israel is doing. I mean, way back 20 years ago, the EU conducted an opinion poll, and some poor junior accidentally included Israel in the poll, and it came top across the whole of Europe. Citizens thought that it was the major threat to world peace, or more of them thought Israel was a major threat to world peace than any other country. So Israel looked at that and recognized it as a profound crisis in terms of hostility. So you can't simply stand your ground and defend Israel. What you have to do is divide and rule, is win over some people to a soft or very muted opposition and isolate those who refuse to be to be put in that camp. So for years, we've been accused of Holocaust denial, anti-Semitism, support for terrorism. I don't know what that is. And you know, it's just a constant rain. But other softer groups don't come in for the same treatment. So it's an attempt to divide and rule. That's part of the DNA of Zionism inside Palestine and out.
Yeah.
And who's surprised? You can't defend the project called Zionism and what Israel does, so you have to try and split the opposition in order to weaken it.
So I suppose the inescapable conclusion then, David, is that Nimrod is part of this sort of strategic engagement idea aimed at criticism of Zionism.
Well, the Zionist movement, since its very beginning, since the beginning of the post-existence of occupied Palestine, so when they created this state in 1948, they had their first Zionist Congress, World Zionist Congress, in Jerusalem in 1951, I think it was. And that's when they created the mission statement of the Zionist movement. And the mission statement included spreading Zionist ideas all over the world. I mean, it's perfectly clear that that's what they were doing. And that, of course, is the role of the Zionist movement. So when it comes to trying to influence people who are critical of Zionism, they have to have organizations who seem like they're more sympathetic or more liberal, that liberal Zionists, people even who say that they're non-Zionist, and some who say they're anti-Zionist. Now, not all of those who say that they're anti-Zionist are anti-Zionist in any kind of material or straightforward way. And that's of course, the difficulty is that some people, even they might even believe that they're anti-Zionist, but they're not really anti-Zionist. And that's partly a question of a sort of penetration strategy by the Zionist movement. And Nimrod clearly is part of that strategy. Now, everyone in Nimrod might not know that, they might not believe that, but that's the purpose of Nimrod. It's to try and isolate those who are sort of more thoroughgoingly anti-Zionist from those who are a bit more questionable.
No, indeed. Well, Mick, I assume that PSC Scotland's not going to be platforming Nimrod anytime soon then.
People carry in their heads strange ideas. I mean, some people still think Columbus discovered America. They're not hardcore racists. We are perfectly ready to engage with people if they have, you know, backward ideas. But it depends on the direction they're moving in. If people are breaking from Zionism and moving, however stumblingly, however with whatever difficulty, towards support for Palestinian rights and freedom and abandoning Jewish supremacy, then we'd be delighted to engage with them. But if they're dug in and trying to bring other people towards these positions of not criticising Zionism root and branch, then I don't see any possibility for serious engagement. But yes, we'd be happy to engage with them in order to see who among them was prepared to make the final step towards repudiating Zionism. Look, many of us have had to repudiate reactionary ideas. I know people who grow up in all sorts of backgrounds. We had to repudiate the idea that Churchill was anything other than a rancid racist, or that the British Empire was endless pillage and massacre and conquest. We had to break from those ideas. Yeah. So nobody's exempt from that. But if people are not prepared to, and if people are, I'll engage with people who are moving away from those ideas. But if they're promoting ideas that the British Empire was justified in pillaging the world, there's nothing to discuss. And it's the same with Nimrod. If they're dug in any way defending the genocidal state, Israel has a right to exist, blah, 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 then what's to discuss?
Yeah, well, indeed. Well, I'm afraid that's all we've got time for today. So a special thank you to our guest, Mick Napier. And thanks, of course, to our resident expert, Professor David Miller. Until next time, when I hope you'll join us again on Palestine Declassified, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
Faqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Emmet is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of Arab English Radio. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Donishman. Please stay tuned. From early morning to the late night, how many people do we bother or do break their hearts? How much do we ignore the feelings of others and how much do we send them negative signals? Why do we darken the hearts of the people with sad news and why do we interact with them with cold and lifeless feelings? These behaviors are very much witnessed in modern era. We see the people who can see the happiness and prosperity of their fellow brothers and sisters.
Adam is Salem, Adam is Imam Hussein.
A healthy follower of God and Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam will never break the heart of his brothers and sisters in faith. In the Quran, we read in the story of Prophet Solomon that when the head of the ant brought him half of a seed of wheat as a gift, Prophet Solomon welcomed this gift as if it was very much precious to him. Thus, when the ant got back to the other ants, he told them, Solomon accepted our gifts as the best gift. This is how a prophet of Allah welcomes an ant who brings him a seed of wheat. See how much respect he had for this tiny creature of Allah. We must learn to be kind to others and never break their hearts. This is an Islamic morality. Thank you very much, dear listeners of Arab English Radio, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Donishman. To find more about this program and our other programs, please visit our new website at iranradio.ir. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
We are with you. What about you? Meaningful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Washington Attorney General Nick Brown joined with Oregon in filing a lawsuit against President Donald Trump's effort to impose new election procedures on the states. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. The American newspaper, the Seattle Times, has covered the story and tells us more. Washington's Attorney General Nick Brown filed a lawsuit on Friday, 4th of April, against President Donald Trump's attempt to alter election procedures across the United States, challenging what he described as an unconstitutional and illegal attack on democracy. Washington teamed with Oregon to file the lawsuit, which is similar to the one filed on Thursday, 3rd of April, by California and 18 other states, according to Washington Attorney General Nick Brown. The legal actions are directed at an executive order by Donald Trump last week that calls for requiring people to provide documentary proof of citizenship when registering to vote and for mail-in ballots to be received by elections office no later than Election Day. The Washington-Oregon lawsuit was filed in U.S. District Court in Seattle, Washington. Neither the Constitution nor any federal law gives the president the power to set rules for how states conduct elections, Nick Brown said during a news conference at his downtown Seattle office. Only the Constitution and congressional action can change how states handle voting, he said. The president has absolutely no authority to do what he's purporting to do, Nick Brown added. He was joined at the news conference by Washington Secretary of State Steve Hobbs and State Representative Charlotte Mina. Nick Brown added, "We will not let this attempt to assert control over our constitutional rights go unchecked. It is highly important that we fight these efforts and not become numb to tyranny." The Washington-Oregon lawsuit says Donald Trump's order violates multiple provisions of the Constitution, including the Elections Clause, saying the clause gives states primary authority to regulate the time, place, and manner of federal elections. The lawsuit says President Trump's order also violates multiple federal laws, including the National Voter Registration Act of 1993, which says people can attest to their U.S. citizenship when registering to vote. Reacting to the lawsuit filed by California and other states, White House spokesperson Harrison Fields defended President Trump's proof of citizenship order as common sense and called objections by Democratic leaders insane. The Trump administration is standing up for free, fair, and honest elections, Harrison Fields said. Trump's 25th of March executive order builds on his long-standing complaints about U.S. elections, including his false claims on widespread voter fraud and voting machine manipulation in his 2020 loss to Democrat Joe Biden. In his 2024 presidential campaign, Donald Trump claimed there would be rampant fraud, but he has been mostly quiet on that front since his victory. Nick Brown said Washington and Oregon decided to sue on their own rather than join Thursday's lawsuit, partly because the Pacific Northwest states have similar mail-in systems that could be uniquely affected by President Trump's agenda. Washington's voting system is already secure, fair, and particularly accessible, Hobbs said on Friday, 4th of April. Trump's election order, if carried through, could disenfranchise hundreds of thousands of voters here, especially older adults, low-income voters, and naturalized citizens, according to Washington's Secretary of State. Hobbs added, "Let's be clear, federal law already prohibits non-citizens from voting. Every voter in our state must attest to their citizenship, and we regularly maintain our voter rolls. Registering to vote in Washington, if you're not a citizen, is a felony, punishable by up to 5 years imprisonment. Registration requires a driver's license or state-issue ID card, and without either of those, one can register by using a social security number. Many states, including Washington and Oregon, accept ballots postmarked on or before Election Day, including when they are received in the mail after Election Day. The mail-in process has helped Washington achieve one of the country's best voter participation rates, according to Attorney General Nick Brown. Washington is now part of 11 lawsuits against the Trump administration, according to Nick Brown. Brown predicted that at this rate, there will be many more to come. The national broadcaster ABC News has also covered the same story. Washington and Oregon on Friday, 4th of April, became the latest states to ask a court to reject President Donald Trump's efforts to overhaul elections in the United States, just a day after Democratic officials in 19 other states filed a similar lawsuit. Washington Attorney General Nick Brown added, "Neither the Constitution nor any federal law gives the president authority to set rules for how states conduct elections." Nick Brown, a Democrat, speaking at a news conference in Seattle, said, "It is the states that decide how voters are registered. It is the states that decide how ballots are counted." Friday, 4th of April's lawsuit in U.S. District Court in Seattle is the fifth against the executive order since it was issued last week. The order includes new requirements that people provide documentary proof of citizenship when registering to vote, and a demand that all mail ballots be received by Election Day. It also puts states' federal funding at risk if election officials don't comply. That could disenfranchise hundreds of thousands of voters in the Pacific Northwest of the United States, where ballots must be postmarked but not necessarily received by Election Day. Washington Secretary of State Steve Hobbs noted at a news conference that more than 300,000 ballots in Washington arrived after Election Day last year. Steve Hobbs added, "President Trump's executive order is nothing more than a blatant attempt to rig the system and suppress votes." Oregon's Attorney General Dan Rayfield, speaking at a news conference, said, "Trump is trying to make it harder for people to vote. It's a direct assault on the Constitution and a brazen attempt to act like a king, dictating how states should run their elections." The lawsuits from the states follow earlier ones against the executive order by nonprofit voting groups and the Democratic National Committee, the DNC. They say the order could disenfranchise voters because millions of eligible voting age Americans do not have the proper documents readily available. People already are required to attest to being U.S. citizens under penalty of perjury in order to vote. The lawsuits have said Donald Trump's directive violates the Constitution, which specifies that states have the authority to set the times, places, and manner of elections. The U.S. Congress has the power to make or alter regulations for elections for president and Congress, but the Constitution doesn't mention any presidential authority over election administration. White House spokesperson Harrison Fields on Friday, 4th of April, called the Proof of Citizenship Requirements Common Sense, and said the administration is standing up for free, fair, and honest elections. President Trump has continued to claim that he won the 2020 election despite all evidence to the contrary. Courts of law have rejected dozens of his legal challenges, and his attorney general at the time said there was no sign of widespread voter fraud. Reviews, recounts, and audits in the battleground states where he contested his loss all confirmed that Democrat Joe Biden won the election. He and other Republicans also promoted the idea during last year's presidential election that large numbers of people who were not U.S. citizens actually voted. Voting by non-citizens is rare in the United States and, when caught, can lead to felony charges and even deportation. Washington Attorney General Nick Brown said it is hard to imagine a subject where this president has less credibility than he does with elections. Nick Brown cited Trump's lies about the 2020 presidential election and his loss to Joe Biden. He added, he's always looking to undermine faith in our democracy.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on Iran Radio. With me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Well, let's talk about or delve into some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature according to fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. And let me begin this episode with this question, Sheikh. Which types of marine animals are halal to eat?
Well, this is a very good question. A lot of people outside the country, Iran, for example, live nearby sea, and they want to know about what kind of seafoods are halal for them, or what kind of seafoods they find in the market and they can buy and can consume. That's a pretty important question.
Yes,
of course. According to His Eminence, among the sea foods or the sea animals, only scaled fish are halal, okay? And shrimps are also halal.
But they're not scaled.
Yeah, they are not scaled. Shrimps are an exception.
Yes.
When we talk of scaled fish, there are many species of scaled fish, okay? And some of the fish might not have scales at the if you look at them. But if you ask the fishermen whether this fish is from the category of scaled fish or not,
yes,
they will say, okay, it is from the category of scaled fish. The scales are gone, but they're still considered to be scaled or scaly fish.
Yes.
Therefore, it is permissible to eat and to consume such fish. And let's also tell, I should say that, that Sunni Muslims eat non-scaled fish as well. They eat prawns, they eat lobsters, they eat
crabs.
Oysters, crabs, and these things. I've been there too many places. I've seen them eating these things. According to them, all of these seafoods are halal. Mm-hmm. It's, could be some exceptions. But Sunni Muslims, okay, it's very much important to make sure that the fish you eat, even if you are living in a Muslim country, it's necessary to make sure that the fish or the seafood you eat is halal, okay? Make sure you do not eat, for example, clams instead of shrimps, lobsters instead of some other kind of sea animals, okay? And scaled fish also, there are many, many varieties of scaled fish, and they are available everywhere.
Yes.
If you live in a non-Muslim country, let's say you live in India, okay? India is where is a place where you barely find any halal meat, okay? You cannot slaughter cows or any oxen because the Hindus, fearing the Hindus, you cannot slaughter them openly. And even you don't have any, for example, beef market there in India, because the Hindus do not allow cows to be slaughtered. So if you want to eat meat because you are starving, okay, because of not having meat, so make sure you eat fish instead of beef, okay? Yes. Beef is halal in itself, but you cannot find it. So in order to just have your some kind of meat, you can eat scaled fish, and even if you get it from a Hindu, that it's okay. It's okay as long as it's scaled. It is halal to eat.
Well, there are two questions that cross my mind, Sheikh.
Yes.
About the scaled fish.
Yeah.
First of all, regarding the scaled fish.
Yeah.
You said that they need to be scaled so that they it would be actually open to us. I mean, as halal food,
yes.
Right? But, you know, some fish might have scales, but they're only seen with, some kind of technology, right? Like, for example, microscope or something. Do you mean with naked eyes that you will be able to see the scales and that would make the fish halal for you?
This is the first question. I think scales are something you don't need to use a microscope or something to find the scales. Okay? Uh-huh. The scales might fall off sometimes, and the fish might lose its scales. Okay, if the fisherman called the fish to be scaled, and to be from the category of scaled fish, that's enough. Okay.
I see. Okay.
Yes.
I'll ask the second question that crossed my mind after the break. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions. Allah, yeah, Allah. Guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah. Don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Welcome back to the program, Islamic Laws on Iran Radio, with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini. Well, Sheikh Javid, I promised our dear audience actually to ask one of the other questions related to your words before the break, and when you were talking about the halal marine animals or sea animals. Let's say you mentioned that, for example, if you live in a non-Muslim dominated area, like, for example,
non-Muslim
yes. areas, right? Like, for example, the Indian subcontinent that you gave as an example. You said that some meats, are not available in the market. You don't have the beef market, and they don't allow it there. So it's safer actually to go to the sea market and find some scaled fish over there, right?
Right.
But do you have to investigate how the scaled fish are caught? Because we know that, you know, the fish should be out of the water and they die in the dirt, for example, out of the water.
Yes.
And if they are caught, for example, in nets or caught in another way, which they die in the water, that would not make it halal for us, right?
Yes, you're
so
right.
So what about this? Do we have to investigate, for example, how they catch the fish?
Well, the same question can apply to fish found in Muslim country and in a Muslim country.
In the Muslim countries, so you give it the benefit of the doubt.
You give the benefit of the doubt.
Because they are Muslims and they know the rules.
Yes, you're
right. But in the non-Muslim areas, you can't give it the benefit of the doubt. Do you have to keep investigating about it?
You are right. The thing is that fish are generally caught in large numbers.
Yes.
Okay? And the fisherman does not kill the fish inside the water with something, okay? They are usually, and for example, in 95% of the cases, the fish are brought out and they are let to die on the deck of the fish or on outside the water.
Right.
So that's why for that very strong probability, we are allowed by the Sharia to eat the fish that are sold in the non-Muslim market, be that Muslim non-Muslim market, a Christian non-Muslim market, or a Hindu non-Muslim market, it is okay to eat the fish that has scale.
I see. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh. Let's take a break, and then we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws. Stay with us.
اللهم صل على سيدنا ونبينا محمد وآله.
Welcome back to the program Islamic Laws on iranradio.ir with me, Muhammad Jahad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the jurisprudential laws of miscellaneous nature based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, somebody asked us, my father died and I don't know if he had any khums here or not. Is the inheritance from our late father subject to khums? In other words, does the individual have to pay, or should he pay the khums on the part of his or her father?
You know, generally speaking, according to all religious scholars, inheritance is not liable for khums. You know, it's not necessary to pay khums on what an individual inherits from his father, mother, or any other relatives. Okay, there are different possibilities. Okay, if, for example, you are not sure that he owes khums, or his property is subject to khums, you do not have to pay khums because you are not sure. But if you are sure that your father used to pay khums and he failed to pay khums from the property you have inherited, or the asset that you that is available now in his bank account. In this case, because you're sure, you must pay his debt to khums like his other debts at first, and then, of course, distribute the rest among the heirs. That's the point.
Okay. If the first income of the new year occurs with a time interval after the end of the khums year, can the beginning of the new khums year be set as the date of the first income?
Religious authorities, as far as I know, has permitted their followers to change the date of the khums according to the to the beginning of the according to their first income, and whenever it is convenient and it's possible for them to pay khums, like for example if they want to change their khums date from the first of Muharram to the first of Rabiul Awwal, or from the from the 1st of Muharram to the 1st of Nowruz, according to the Persian calendar.
Mm.
So it is permissible. And His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei also maintains that there's no problem in shifting the date of Khums to some other dates.
I see. Well, Shechovit, what is the duty if one doubts whether Khums is due on the capital with which he earns his living or not?
If the original capital is from his income and no Khums has been paid on it, it is subject to Khums at the end of the Khums year.
Mm-hmm, I see.
And of course, it is not obligatory to pay Khums. It is Khums in the following cases, according to His Eminence. Number one, if after paying it is Khums, the income earned by using the rest of the capital is not enough for living expenses, in this case, it's not obligatory to pay Khums. And then number two, if after paying its Khums, the business to be managed with the rest of the capital is not compatible with his station as per common people, or he doubts whether this is the case or not, in this case, Khums is not payable.
Thank you very much, Javid. Thank you, my dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on iranradio.ir with me, Muhammad Javad, the host of this program. We bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
رحمن رحيم منان كريم سلام عليم لا إله إلا هو غفار جميل وهاب لطيف تواب سميع بصير
The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Forces have killed nearly 40 Palestinians in the Gaza Strip since dawn, including children and journalists. Lebanon says an Israeli drone attack claims another life in the south as Tel Aviv continues to violate the ceasefire agreement with the Arab country. And stock markets in Asia and Europe stumble as uncertainties grow globally over Trump's newly announced tariffs against world countries. Hello and welcome. Let's go ahead and get started with the stories that matter. The Israeli regime presses ahead with its genocidal war on Gaza. One of the latest attacks hit a media tent and set it ablaze. A video showing a journalist Ahmad Mansour being burned alive has gone viral. He is fighting for his life. The Israeli strike on that media tent located near Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis has killed at least two people, one of them being a journalist. Several others were injured, six of them journalists. A day earlier, another journalist was killed along with her husband and child. Israeli strikes have killed at least 37 Palestinians since.